Man, now you know what's life in the next podcast. I ain't even gotta tell you, so why don't you just sit right there and enjoy the show? That is right, ladies and gentlemen. It is time for Life in Equinox Podcast Millennium number 11. Pretty exciting. At least I think it's exciting. You're probably sitting there going, "Not this again, why?" Well, the reason is because I have nothing else to do on a Saturday morning, and I don't feel like doing schoolwork. Because I'm just that way. Don't judge me! But we have a pretty exciting podcast today. On the menu is Glengarry Glen Ross, All the President's Men, Rambo, and Hunger. Followed by a little conversation spinning off my post on Subs and Dubs. If you're curious, you can find this podcast and posts related to many of the movies at A Life in Equinox, univarn.blogspot.com. That's univarn, univarn.blogspot.com. But, as you know, I like to start these things off with a little walk down memory lane, uni style. And as I'm sure many of you are aware, there's the sort of 10 movie facts meme going around. And I recently posted mine, I think, last Sunday, as I was tagged by Film Forager and You Talking About Me Movies, Mike Lippert. And it started with He Shot Cyrus, so apparently I'm just gonna start naming blogs until I self-implode. But one of the things I mentioned on there that I think I've kind of noticed on a few others is, as a kid, I was really wary of violence. I didn't like it in movies. I loved the action, I just didn't like the violence. I can't explain it. And I don't know when this started happening, but it got to the point where I just wouldn't watch graphic movies. And so right around the age 10, 11, 12, when I was starting to be allowed to watch rated R movies, what would happen is my parents would rent the like an R-rated movie for them and then like a family movie. And we would watch the family movie, and then me and my sister would go to our rooms and we'd go to sleep. And so I fell asleep a lot listening to loud explosions as my parents watched the R-rated films. And I don't know what it was, but something about the screaming and such, I could never handle it. And that's the point where I'd always go downstairs after the movie and ask my mom, "So what happened? And is it an R-rated movie I can watch?" And she'd say yes or no. And one of the first movies to break this gap was Air Force One, the Harrison Ford, Gary Oldman film. Because it wasn't really violent, but it had quite a bit of language. Not even that, it didn't even have that quite a bit of language, I don't remember. I remember it being a very weak R-rated film. Well, that's just the way I remember it. I mean, the one guy gets, parachuted, neck slap. It's all for the children. But that was one of the first movies that really brought out, and I still love that movie to the day. I don't care how cheesy and corny that movie gets, I'll always watch it. And the movie, I think, though, that really kind of broke my graphic weariness was kind of The Matrix on some level. It wasn't that graphic, but it was a good I guess bridge gapping movie, kind of getting me in between the two. And nowadays I'll watch violent movies, but I don't like to watch them on the big screen. Like when we went to watch Saw 3, I went with a couple group of friends, and just seeing the bones crack on the big screen and the loud, I'm like, I'm cringing, and my sister's over there laughing because she thinks it's just so fake, or I don't know, my sister's weird that way, but she's laughing, and I'm sitting there going, oh, come on, do we have to see that? No, but. And that actually is what kind of spawned my poll this week about violence in movies, because I tend to find I'm in the, it's generally okay. I don't like too much use of it, but a little bit of violence every once in a while is not so bad, especially if they come with either a comical flair, like shoot 'em up, or a moralistic flair, kind of like in Bruges and such, where there is graphic violence, but there's sort of a moralistic and fantastical spin to it. And I suppose we should start off by going from violence to a violent movie. Last week, I had just a sudden hankering for a cheesy action movie. And a friend of mine asked me if I had ever seen the latest Rambo film. Not the originals, I've seen all three of the originals. Cheesetastic. And so, I went to watch the movie. It's directed by Sylvester Stallone, as you probably know, co-written by Stallone, starring Stallone. Yada, yada, yada. It also has a couple of actors I kind of enjoy, even though they haven't done a lot of good stuff, Julie Benz and Matthew Marsden. And I get why fans of action kind of like it, but to be honest, I thought it was just a god-awful. I mean, first and foremost, we know when you're going to a Stallone movie, you're not getting great acting. But usually he carries a certain charm or a goofiness to the character. Here, something's happened to Stallone. He just looks like a walking brick wall with nothing going on behind, you know? He scares me looking at him. He just looks like a free, you know, kind of like the Thing. That's what he looks like. The Thing from the Fantastic Four. He looks like that because he's been juiced up so many years. He used to look, you know, at, you know, tough guy, but, you know, like someone you could walk up to on the street and be like, wow, he's strong. Not, wow, is that human? And then you compound that with the action in this movie, which is just, I don't know. It felt like the Bruce Willis movie, Into the Sun, except without any desire or care about the characters. I mean, you know, John Rambo's going to have a couple longing stares and quiet nothingness, but the Julie Benz character and her fellow missionaries were all just rather, I don't know, annoying. You know, I don't know. I really didn't care about any of the characters, even Rambo, and I've always liked the character of Rambo. No matter how cheesy or over-the-top the character's been, I've always enjoyed it. But here it just felt like there was nothing there. The action wasn't even that interesting to me. I mean, great, he gets on a gigantic machine gun and starts wailing bullets into the crowd of people. Or, not people, you know, evil army men who are evil and rawr because they have mustaches and shoot each other. I don't know. They were bad guys, trust. Don't get me wrong. The movie does a good job of establishing the bad guys. But they were too comically bad. I don't know. I kind of expected one of them to start talking with an evil accent and start twirling a mustache. But that's only in my dreams. Secretly. Overall, though, I didn't care. And I wanted, for some reason, when I'm into action movies, I want to care. Even if it's so stupid that you laughing at it. I wanted to either laugh at it or enjoy it. I didn't do either. I just kind of sat there and going, great. Ooh, look, another flying body part. That's exactly what I wanted. So, I don't know. Movies like Rambo, they don't do a lot for me. I want a flair, something to attach to, and it didn't offer anything. And I think that's my problem with a lot of modern action movies. At least that kind of action movie. But, I mean, if you're into action, I'm sure you'd probably enjoy it. For me, it'd probably get about a 4 out of 10, if I ever really cared enough to review it. But we're going to segue here from a movie that I don't care to review to a movie I did review. Actually, a couple movies I've reviewed. And this is going to be a little classic segment. We're going to go back to back. The 1992 film Glengarry Glen Ross, directed by James Foley, written by David Mamet, based on the play by himself. Himself being Mamet, not Foley, just in case you were curious. Well, I mean, how do you really describe Glengarry Glen Ross? I think the best way you can probably say it is, give me better leads! I need better leads! Because they said the word leads so many times in the movie, my head almost exploded! I was twitching for about 3 hours. I need leads, man! I need the leads! Come on, man, I need some leads! Yeah, me and crack addicts. Just like Mom used to make. Does that make sense? Nope. Do I care? Not really. But one of the things about Glengarry Glen Ross is that it's a performance piece. I don't think I could say it better. It's a movie that has a very simple story to it, you know. A group of real estate salesmen trying to succeed in the harsh corporate environment. And then, okay, we got that. 5 seconds in, boom. Now show the characters. You start off with, you know, Jack Lemmon, you end with Jack Lemmon, the movie middles with Jack Lemmon. While Pacino probably get a little bit more recognition for the movie, I have no idea why. Jack Lemmon was absolutely amazing in the movie. That final conversation between him and Spacey, I nearly jumped out of my seat and gave an applause. That was just beautiful acting. That was pure, powerful acting. And then you counteract that with Ed Harris and Alan Arkin and Jonathan Pryce. And then the Alec Baldwin infamous speech, you know, he pulls out the you know, the brass balls and he holds them in front of himself. It's like, that's what you need to sell. If you don't sell, you're nothing. And it's such a harsh, mentally draining environment. And these actors just nail it. You imagine just like high-fiving each other after every scene. Suck on them apples, Keanu. Don't ask me why I said Keanu. Because I can, and because maybe it relates. But there was such an amazing performances by these actors. I was captivated and gripped, and I wanted to see more of it, and I wanted to see what they were going to do next, because each character has so many different flaws, and each conversation opens up something else about them, you know? The Jack Lemmon central character of Sidney Levine is really the one we get to know the most, but we even get to see, you know, through conversations between each other and conversations about each other, the strengths and weaknesses of each of the characters, and it's so well presented for the viewer. It's Foley Mamet just package it so well and to say, here are your lines, here is a camera, do what you do best, I'm not getting in the way. And I love that when directors can do that, when you can trust the cast so much that you don't have to, you know, show a face, cut, show a face, cut, show a face, cut, show a face, cut. And you can just put the camera and show both of them in one shot and just have them act. Because when you can do that, it's such a powerful tool when you have talented actors. And they had powerful actors, and they nailed it home. It was a great movie. It got near a 9 out of me on a 10. And that's about as high as I'll go for a first-time movie without some incredibly, incredibly, you know, scenes. And the one problem I had with Glengarry and Glenn Ross is that at times I felt like not a lot was happening. The conversations, unless you really get into the acting, the conversations aren't going to be interesting at all because they're just talking about real estate lingo and bad leads. So there is that. If you're not a person who watches movies and really gets into acting, I would not recommend Glengarry Glenn Ross just because of that factor. But then again, I would recommend it anyways just because it's such amazing performances. You can't really take your eyes off the screen when any of the actors are in front of it. And that's just a talented, talented film. And I also got another really sort of, I don't know, gift of performances in that I got to watch the movie All the President's Men. Now, this was the 1001 Movies You Must See Club. That's 1001moviesyoumustsee.blogspot.com, based on the movie 1001 Movies to See Before You Die. That's a lot of saying the same thing over and over and over again, so I'm going to stop doing that and move on to my review. That's right. Alan Palooka, directed, written by William Goldman, based on the book, and I guess autobiography in many respects, of Carl Bernstein, who's played by Dustin Hoffman, and Bob Woodward, who's played by Robert Redford. And really, it's chronicles their 7 months, during which they, right after the Watergate, to when they really started to get into and realizing how big the Watergate scandal reached. And what I found most striking about it was that sentiment of realism the movie had. Because, I mean, there's scenes where you don't catch every dialogue because they don't want you to catch every line of dialogue. You know, they're rushing out the door, and so you just see them rushing out the door, and they're just yelling something at, you know, the secretary. And the way they act, Hoffman and Redford just feel so as if they've done it every day, as if this is their job, and they've been there for years, or 9 months in Woodward's case, and that's what they know how to do. And I love that sentiment of realism. I don't buy so much. I know a lot of my fellow bloggers are really into, especially my journalism majors, you know, these movies that have the old-school, real reporting attitude. You know, back when reporters were reporters, and real, and yeah. I like it, but in here, I think it works though because it was the time, and because you get to see the amount of work they had to put into. And the way it's developed worked so well, because you carry on all these conversations, and they have a very difficult task, because they have to get you to not get lost in this absolute sea of names of people involved in this thing. And odds are you're going to be sitting there going, I have no idea who that is, I have no idea who that was, I have no idea who that is, I have no idea who that was. You know? And they nail it because they reiterate and they concentrate. And that's an important thing to do with a movie like this. Because you got to think, these days it's been what? Well, the election was in 72, so 38 years since the Watergate scandal. And because they do it with such a well job, you don't need to know a lot about the events without keeping up with the film. You know, you don't get lost because they do a lot of the way they play off of the people they're trying to get the things out of also ends up helping you as a viewer, because they'll sit there and go, we know it was, you know, Secretary of Treasury Jackson Wallace, right? You know, and you're like, ah, oh, okay, yes, I know what that job, I know Secretary of Treasury, that sounds important, so he's probably someone we should be thinking about. And they do that so well that it really helps build the movie, and it builds the tension. And not to mention, the movie also stars Jason Robards, and this was actually his Oscar-winning Best Supporting Role, which I don't really have any opinion on other than say Jason Robards is awesome, and that's just enough of that. And he's just really good in this movie because he plays the boss, you know, the editor-in-chief, I think, or whatever the role is. I always get those mixed up. And here he's such a strong presence and sort of a watchful eye and a guide for the two main characters that it really works to complement Hoffman and Redford, who are just carrying the scene so well. And then you have Hal Holbrook, who I absolutely adore, and his recent performance in Into the Wild was one of actually my favorite supporting performances of that year. And he really just handles the deep throat character. He has such an allure of mystery and curiosity around him. It just works perfectly. And the whole movie, I think, just works. It's highly, highly entertaining. I was really captivated by all the things it was showing me. I really cared about the characters. I really cared about where the story was going. Even though I knew where it was going, I was always gripped. Like, how did they get this? How did they get that fact? How did they get this fact? You know, nobody's talking to them. How did they get it? And then the way they got it, it was so well designed and directed and presented. It allowed you to feel as if you were part of it, not just a mere observer. And that was a great decision by Palooka in the directing front, you know. And when you have a director who's on his game like that, you're just not going to fail. And that's going to lead me into my sort of feature review for today. I don't know if I'd say feature, but last review, either way you want to put it. And that's going to be the 2009-2008 Irish film Hunger, directed by Steve McQueen. Not that one. Though he does ironically look a little bit like Forrest Whitaker. We're not going to go into that. And stars Michael Fassbender, who, I'll tell you what, after this performance, he should have won the Oscar last year. That's all I'm saying. Jeff Bridges, like you. Sorry. Step aside. Package it up. Send it to Michael Fassbender. His performance in this movie? Wow. It's like that Christian Bale the Machinist performance. Nobody respects it because it's foreign and it's too difficult to watch, but holy crap is it amazing. And on some level, I think that echoes the entire movie. Because what will strike, I think, most viewers about Hunger when you first watch it is how quiet it is. Even during its loudest moments, Hunger is incredibly quiet. There's no real soundtrack, no real musical anthem, you know, playing up the scenes. You know, the very first scene, we see a man checking under his car for a bomb. The next scene, we see him, you know, bloody knuckled. And then we see a guy, you know, a prisoner coming into this prison. And he walks into his cell, and all he sees lining the wall is feces, just lining the wall. And in the corner, there's a whole bunch of crap and gunk and food, and it's impossible to explain the visuals this movie presents in mere words. They are that just, let's just say this much, don't eat and watch the movie Hunger. I know that may be rather amusing, slight giggle, but trust me on this, you're not going to want to eat for a while. It's just, it hard hits. It's so realistic and powerful that you can't believe that some of these people had to live in these situations, regardless of the political things that were going on in the 80s, and 70s, and 60s, and 90s. Gurgle, shh. You just couldn't believe that people had to live in this, and lived in it. And then it really does a good job because two-thirds of the movie is spent building up to the actual hunger strike, which is the infamous event led by Bobby Sands, who is Michael Fassbender portrays. And that's when it really starts to shift, because we see the entry from individuals who are coming into the prison, and we see their life in prison. And then it switches to Bobby Sands for the last half of the movie. And there's just such a powerful dynamic there. I really just couldn't help but be shocked by it. And I have to say, the entire movie's that way. It doesn't let up on the realism. It doesn't let up on the graphicness of the portrayal. It's going to show you how difficult this life was. And it's going to make you approach it. And it's going to be very painful. But it's so well done that I just couldn't believe it. It was amazing, amazing to watch. One of the best movies I've seen in a long while. And I'm talking about recent movies, new movies. It's one of those movies that you don't want to watch again. Mad Hatter talks about this quite a bit. Movies you don't watch twice. And I think this is one of those movies you watch once and you're like, holy crap, I don't want to see that again. That was amazing, but please keep that over there in that corner. I'm fine over here. I'm going to go have some biscuits. And I just really, I could not recommend the movie enough for people who love film, like who love that sort of gritty realism in film, and who can swallow it. Because like I said, it's very quiet, it's very slow moving. It's, even for a 90-minute movie, it doesn't jam you with action and such. You know, it's going to hit you hard, it's going to hit you often, but it's not going to be pretty. And it actually relates to the last topic I have today. The Floating Red Couch, whose blog, Floating Red Couch, on my recent post on subtitles versus dubbings, which thank you to everyone who commented on that, it's actually quickly become one of my most viewed and commented pieces. He talked about watching movies that are in English, but in foreign accents, or in accents that are foreign to us, you know, such as Irish and Scottish and English, in movies that are so difficult because you can't really just understand what they're saying. And that's from, in his talk, and what he mentioned in it was the movie The Acid House, which I haven't seen, so I can't say anything about that, but there's, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, is it okay to watch a movie in English with English subtitles, even though you're technically supposed to be able to know what's going on? I had this trouble with quite a few Irish films, like Dead Man's Shoes, and more recently, Once. The first time I watched that, I actually really struggled with the accents. And another example would be Sukiyaki Western Django, which is a Japanese movie that's done in English. I couldn't understand him, and he talks about, is it okay to do subs there? And I did. I whipped out the subtitles, because it's like, I'd rather hear it in the natural tongue, the way they wanted you to hear it, in subtitles, even if it's already supposed to be in my language and I just can't understand their accent. Because I feel this way when some actors even do interviews, such as Robert Carlyle, who did the Full Monty. He recently did an interview on Late Night Show with Craig Ferguson, and he's got like a Scottish accent, and I can't understand a thing he's saying in his natural accent. It's just like, it's so thick and heavy. I can't make the translation. It doesn't work in my head. Nope. And so, I don't think there's anything wrong with subtitles in that. I mean, I had trouble in Hunger, but it wasn't so bad, because most of the actors really take the time to try and, I don't know, really work it. I don't know if they were trying to make it sound okay. There was a few times I sat there and went, huh? But for the most part, I understood it alright. But I think, for the most part, there's, if it'll help you see the movie the way it was meant to be seen, to the best of your ability, I think subtitles are okay in all circumstances. Dubs are not my preference, and even if it's in English, because you're not going to get a dub. There's no English dub for an English movie. As much as we may hate that. Sometimes, especially with the thicker accents, but I think, you know, you should go with subtitles. If it helps you watch the movie, always go subtitles. Don't settle for just sitting there not understanding the dialogue. But Floating Our Couch also brings up another good point, that the best movies, the ones that I think are really memorable for all of us, could be told entirely muted and you could understand what was going on. And I like to think about my top 10 like that, because most of these movies I could watch completely quiet, mute, and I'd know what was going on for a lot of them. I wouldn't need a lot of explanation. And I think that's an important thing for movies, to be able to reach beyond their language, regardless of what language that is. To any viewer, that's a pinnacle point of a great movie. The really great, I'm talking about, you know, the 10 out of 10 all-time favorite movies. And some of my movies maybe don't qualify for that, but oh well. I love them anyways. And so I'm going to leave you on that note. That's going to wrap up this week's Life in Equinox podcast. If you want to check out any other podcasts, leave a comment, or read any of the reviews for some of the movies you heard me talk about here, you can visit me at univarn.blogspot.com. UNIVARN is how you spell Univarn. And that's going to wrap it up for this week. Hope you all have a great day. Bye.